Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Our guest today is Nina Totenberg, legal affairs correspondent for National Public Radio. She has won almost every major award in journalism, including but not limited to a Peabody for her coverage of the confirmation hearings for Clarence Thomas and the allegations against Thomas by Anita Hill, and the DuPont Columbia University Silver Baton for her coverage of Supreme Court nominations. Ms. Totenberg is scheduled to speak at MTSU in conjunction with Constitution Day. Her lecture is titled Establishing Justice, the New Supreme Court, and we are truly happy and grateful to have Nina Totenberg slated to speak on campus and to have her on the phone with us now from her Washington office. Hello, Ms. Totenberg. Thanks for taking the time from your busy schedule to be on MTSU on the Record.
It's my pleasure.
When the High Court convenes on the first Monday in October, what sorts of cases are they expected to take up?
Well, there are a wide diversity of cases and a lot waiting in the wings that we don't know if they're going to hear their cases testing. There's a case testing an earlier iteration of the Arizona immigration law. This one's being challenged, actually, by the Chamber of Commerce. There is a case testing whether a minister who believes that the military encourages homosexual behavior, whether he has a constitutional right to protest at the funeral of a dead soldier who, parenthetically, was not gay, as far as I know, anyway. There are cases that test the limits of prosecutorial immunity. There's a case from California testing a state law that bans certain kinds of violent videos for kids. I have not had time to go through the entire list, but those are just a few that come to mind quickly.
One of the most high-profile legal issues this year has been Prop 8 in California, the question of whether a state can ban same-sex marriage. And the California Supreme Court has refused to order Governor Schwarzenegger and Attorney General Brown to appeal a judge's ruling striking down that ban. What impact do you think that this will have on the case moving forward?
Well, I really don't like to predict what's going to happen. I mean, one of the questions then in the case will be who does have the right to appeal and do they have a right to appeal? But I don't think it's going to get, I think it will inevitably get to the Supreme Court in some form, but not this term. In all likelihood, it won't be in this year.
So it won't be this year, but does this raise an issue of legal standing then?
Yes, right.
There's been a lot said and written about the confirmation process for Supreme Court nominees, and you've covered a great many of them. It's been widely reported during Elena Kagan's confirmation hearings that she said in 1995 that the procedure was a vapid and hollow charade. What is your impression of the confirmation process and its substantiveness or lack thereof?
I think it's probably a pretty vapid and hollow charade. I think she was right. I think it's only become that in the last three or four appointments that nominees are coached to say absolutely nothing, to commit themselves not at all. And while I think that's appropriate in many cases, because most people who get to the court have not thought through all of the issues that are going to come before them, and they don't really know how they're going to come out on those issues. Mm-hmm. Justices there say that over and over again, that they think one thing, then when they start to look at a case, and often think a very different thing by the time they're done. So I think it's appropriate that nominees not commit themselves on some issues, but really what they testify to these days is next to nothing. And senators get very little idea whether it was Democrats facing John Roberts and Sam Alito or Republicans facing Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan. The whole name of the game is to say as little as possible, not as much as you can, to get senators to understand what sort of a person you are.
And then the many of the senators use their question time to, as much as ask questions, deliver speeches that expound on their own personal views of what should and should not be the case on the Supreme Court.
That's absolutely true. And I know that most members of the Supreme Court, I think, look at those confirmation hearings, and they blame television in part, the presence of television, for a lot of grandstanding. And it's one of the things that makes them think, we really don't want to have that in our courtroom. We don't want to have television cameras in our courtroom.
So the confirmation process is one reason why the Supreme Court justices would not like to see cameras in the courtroom during oral arguments before them.
I think that's right.
Do you think that there is ever a likelihood that we will see that in our lifetime? And as a reporter, would you prefer to go down that road or not? Would you like to see cameras in the Supreme Court?
Well, I mean, I think there are good arguments to be made on both sides of this. Certainly, having the audio in important cases adds to the ability of the public to know what goes on in a case. But audio is not video. And I think it's very doubtful that the court will allow cameras in the courtroom, in its courtroom, as long as even one member of the court objects in any serious manner. And therefore, I think that those objections will continue to be there for a long time to come.
Where do we stand now with vacancies in the federal judiciary across the country? Does the White House or the Congress slow down this process or both?
Well, we now, there was a story on the Associated Press the other day saying that President Obama has had less success in winning confirmation for his nominees than any president in modern history. And there are now 102 vacancies on the federal judiciary. That's about one-eighth of the federal judiciary. And I think some two-thirds of them are in districts that are called judicial emergency districts. Certainly, President Obama was slow to nominate people, but it's not as if he didn't, as if he failed to nominate them entirely. And I think any reasonable person would look at the situation and say that the Republicans in the Senate have slow-walked nominations very deliberately to ensure that the process is slowed way down, so that we have seen several instances in which people have been held up for months and months where Republicans prevented a vote with various parliamentary mechanisms. And then when the person was confirmed, that individual was confirmed either unanimously or with only one or two dissenting votes. So I'm not even, you know, most of Obama's nominees have been pretty centrist liberals. I'm not even sure that this is particularly objections to the ideology of individual nominees. By and large, there are probably a few that have jangled some Republican nerves, but it's as if they know they are going to be in power eventually, and the more of these judgeships that they can keep vacant, they will be able to name who sits in those lifetime appointments, and not the Democratic president.
So it's a little political game of chicken going on here.
Well, I don't think it's much chicken, because this is sort of an article of faith with the Republican base. And I think that this is just an area in which Republicans don't want to confirm people as much as possible.
You have covered the legal scene and the Supreme Court for quite some time. How is covering the Supreme Court different from any other beat? It seems to be the least public, most insular part of our government, except for maybe the intelligence community. But you tell me, what has it been like for you?
Well, I'm not sure that insular is the word I would use. After all, when they make a decision, their decision making is completely private, among themselves only. And in that sense, they're unlike every other institution of government. They make the decisions in conference themselves. Nobody else is there, no staff, no law clerks. In fact, their staffs are pretty small. Each of them has three or four law clerks, one or two secretaries, and usually a clerical person, and that's it. And when they make their decisions, they explain them in public at great length, which is not always something that other people do. And they explain it in writing for the world to see. And if you don't like what they have to say, you don't like it, but it's right there.
How have you found covering that beat to be in terms of developing sources and of communicating with people and gaining their trust? What is that like for a reporter?
Well, it's certainly something you do over the years, but it's not, again, like other institutions. You don't have sources in a justice's chambers. You don't call up a law clerk for information. That would be death for the law clerk and probably death for the reporter. You know, over the years, you get to know some members of the court. You may see them socially. You may see them at various legal events. And you try to get to know them a bit and know their, but the main thing is to know their work. It's their work product that's the most important, and reading what they write.
What sort of impact do the clerks who work for the justices have on their thought processes as they sort out the cases before them?
Well, I don't think they have any significant effect, but justices, one of the reasons justices like having young people clerk for them is to give them a little grief, to test what they believe. I interviewed Justice Stevens over the summer, and he writes all the first drafts of his opinions. That's just the way he works. Other justices don't. They ask the law clerks to write the first draft. They tell them what the points are they want to make, but they say, you write the first draft. But Justice Stevens likes to write his own first drafts, and then he gives them to the law clerks. And I said to him, so what's the job of the law clerk? And he said, to make sure I don't look like an idiot.
Do justices like to have clerks who will play the devil's advocate and argue the opposing side as an intellectual exercise to help him understand different arguments? Or do they...
Some like that more than others.
It just depends upon the individual then.
Yes.
As we approach Constitution Day, would you reflect on the state of separation of powers and how the judiciary in general has held up in maintaining its independence from the executive and legislative branches?
Well, Lord knows the Supreme Court values its independence above all else. Certainly there are members of the court who have a judicial philosophy, some more liberal, some more conservative. But if you look at the last, let's say, 20 years or so, and the real conflicts between the executive branch and the rest of the world, as it were, the Supreme Court has resolve those questions, at least in the biggest cases, rather against the executive branch to prevent excess. So in the Clinton versus Jones case, for example, the Supreme Court unanimously said that President Clinton could not postpone trial of a civil case, a sexual harassment case, that his job wasn't that important that he could do that. And then in the Guantanamo cases, the court by votes of 6-3 and 5-3, and eventually 5-4, I think, in one case, ruled that the president couldn't on his own set up a detention camp and detain people indefinitely without them having the chance to go to court and prove that they were improperly being detained, that they had the right under the Constitution to do that.
Well, we've unfortunately run out of time. We know that your time is very limited, and we really appreciate you taking a few moments to speak with us in advance of your visit to talk about establishing justice, the new Supreme Court. Nina Totenberg, I enjoy watching you on Inside Washington on public television, and please continue to keep Charles Krauthammer at bay. Nina Totenberg, legal affairs correspondent for NPR. She'll be at MTSU on September 22nd, which is a Wednesday, in conjunction with Constitution Day, talking about establishing justice, the new Supreme Court. If you want to know more, contact Dr. Mary Evans in the Department of History at mevins@mtsu.edu. That's mevins@mtsu.edu. And to add to our understanding of the Supreme Court and the judiciary in general, our own constitutional law scholar, Dr. John Vile, who is dean of the University Honors College, and also the author of Essential Supreme Court Decisions, Summaries of Leading Cases in U.S. Constitutional Law, which is newly released in the 15th edition. 15th edition, John?
Second one that I've done.
The second That's one right. that you've done.
It's actually been on the market for 55 years plus.
Wow. Okay, so we're dealing with a man who knows his judiciary, okay, and keeps track of the Supreme Court and the various and sundry comings and goings. So what do you think about Elena Kagan's statement that the confirmation process for Supreme Court nominees is a vapid and hollow charade? Do you get tired of turning on C-SPAN and seeing the Senate Judiciary Committee members grandstanding instead of actually asking questions?
There's constant questions as to whether the process might have been better before it was televised. That's a fairly recent phenomenon. Public hearings are actually a fairly recent phenomenon. The confirmation hearings vary extensively. You know, if you have a hearing for a Bork or a Thomas, they can go on for weeks, capture the headlines. I would say the last two have been relatively uneventful, and my guess is that Justice Kagan probably was grateful that they were more vapid than they were the opposite.
How do we know that they didn't grandstand before television? I mean, are there eyewitnesses?
Well, you just wouldn't have. I mean, it wouldn't serve the same purpose. If you grandstand, you know, it's sort of like praying in your closet, as commendable as it is, and no one else sees.
It all goes into the congressional record, but then who reads the congressional record, right?
That's right, and I'm not even sure that all the subcommittee hearings necessarily would have even gotten into the congressional record.
Okay. So what did you think about the selection of Elena Kagan to be the next justice on the Supreme Court to fill the void created by the departure of John Paul Stevens?
I don't think it made a lot of difference. And I think that may be one reason that the opponents never really got much traction. She's replacing essentially the most, certainly one of the two most liberal members, arguably the most liberal member left.
Nominated by Ford, right?
That's right. John Paul Stevens was a Republican, certainly nominated by a Republican, but over the years, partly because the court itself has shifted and partly because he's shifted, he's become more liberal. And so if you replace a liberal with a liberal, you really don't make much impact on the overall standing of the court. And the same to some degree was true of Sonia Sotomayor. You would expect, she's replacing Souter, who again was a Republican appointee but had sort of moved toward the left since he was over there. So I think most people just regarded that it was sort of a wash in the end.
Did you have an opportunity to, or let me phrase this a different way. Do you think that Barack Obama will have another opportunity to nominate a Supreme Court justice before the end of this term?
I think there's a chance that he could end up, of course, there's always a chance he could replace anybody, but I think the most likely chance would be Justice Ginsburg. And again, were that to happen, you'd be replacing essentially a fairly liberal person, presumably with another one. The average is about once every 2.5 years. Sometimes you'll get a president like Jimmy Carter who goes a whole term without making a single appointment, and other times you have someone like President Obama who ends up with two even before the first 2 years are up.
If he were fortunate enough to be a two-term president, might he have another opportunity? Would it be likely that any of the more conservative justices would feel compelled to step down within that time frame?
Again, I think the most likely person to step down is probably Justice Ginsburg. She's had some health problems, relatively old. My guess is that the conservatives would be inclined to hang on as long as they can.
Why are there always delays, seemingly, in appointments to the federal judiciary nationwide at various levels?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a bigger problem. The headlines go to the U.S. Supreme Court justices, but partly as Congress has become increasingly ideological, Republicans don't feel like they have a lot of incentive to confirm Democrats and vice versa. And, I mean, for the last three or four administrations, this has been an ongoing problem.
Do you blame that more on the administration or on the Congress?
Again, I think it's just a sign of the times. I think that the general consensus is that both sides have hardened, have gotten farther away from one another, and it's just easier. You know, Congress always finds it easier not to act than to act. And unfortunately, when it comes to the judiciary, you know, you can eventually get to a point where if you don't have enough judges there, you simply can't get the work done.
Am I to take it from the way you feel about the camera's contribution to the confirmation hearings that you would be averse to seeing cameras in the U.S. Supreme Court?
You know, I think that's a rather close call. Certainly as an educator, one would, you know, there's always an advantage in thinking how good it would be to have in classes to be able to see them. You can, usually on a delayed basis, you can get oral arguments. But even in my own study, I find that I rarely consult them. I'd probably be more inclined if I could actually go home and see them on C-SPAN to do so. So I think it's sort of a mixed bag. I know there are a good number of justices right now who are on the record as saying that they're opposed to it. Wouldn't surprise me if someday we had it.
At least if it was shown on C-SPAN, you would be able to view the oral arguments without punditry. On the other hand, every commercial network would want to tap into C-SPAN's feed, and then they'd use their own pundits anyway.
Sure, sure.
One of the questions I asked Ms. Totenberg is about what it was like for her to cover the Supreme Court, and it just seems to me, in my own personal impression, that it seems to be the most insular part of the government except for the intelligence community. I think it's a mystery to a great many ordinary American citizens. It seems to be a world off to itself.
There was a survey within the last two or three weeks in which people were given a list of four names, I believe, and I can't remember all of them, but they included Thurgood Marshall, who's deceased, two other people, John Paul Stevens, who's retired, and at least one other justice with Roberts, and only 28% of the people could identify even who the Chief Justice was, even when he was on a list, and you'd do about that good if you had just guessed. Some of the justices like it that way. You know, Thurgood Marshall was known for getting in the elevator and pretending to be the elevator operator. And it's, you know, I think
it wouldn't have anything to do with him being African-American.
Well, it
and
probably
to put
did,
on
but
the
I think,
poor, dumb white people.
Well, probably, but I think part of it was just I think he did sort of treasure the fact that even though he was on the Supreme Court, he could have a private life. And John Roberts, I think, as much as anybody, you know, really likes to keep it that way.
Is that why they make so relatively few public appearances, except for the occasional lecture at a university law school and things of that nature?
It is. And, of course, part of it is, you know, typically, and this is true of the confirmation proceedings as well, rarely will they comment on a pending case. And that's after all, what you want to know about. Sotomayor seems to be the justice right now who's sort of taking the lead in public appearances. And I think in part, she has a book coming out on her pre-court years. And I think a little bit like Clarence Thomas has done something similar. They're sort of American success stories. But you really don't find a whole lot in Thomas's on judicial, you know, specific opinions and cases. And I doubt that you will in her case either.
You talked about the country becoming, or at least the country's institutions becoming more ideologically polarized. Adam Liptak, who is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times, published A Sign of the Court's Polarization Choice of Clerks. And the thrust of his article, which was in the Times on September the 6th, was that there are several studies, academic studies, that have found that only in recent years have the clerks who work for the justices, the clerks that the Supreme Court justices hire, been more ideologically in sync with them than likely to present the opposite view by comparison to the Rehnquist Court or the Berger Court or the Warren Court.
A lot depends on the justices. Hugo Black was a person who was known for hiring people who didn't necessarily agree with him. I know when I was in college, one of my friends applied to be a clerk for the U.S. Supreme Court, and he applied specifically for Justice Rehnquist. And when Rehnquist interviewed him, he said, "You know, I noticed that the other clerks have applied for several, and you've only applied for me." And he said, "Well, that's because I want to work for you." And he ended up getting the job. So I suspect that there's always been a little bit of, you know, thought that we're going to try to get a clerk pretty much like ourselves. But again, some people like good arguments, good debates. I suspect if I were a justice, that I'd probably try to get a liberal, a conservative, and a moderate, and let them fight it out and just watch.
Is it good for the process to have a bunch of clerks who just agree with you all the time? I mean, I think of the nine wise guys or gals in robes up there as supposedly charged with being the quintessential critical thinkers. I mean, that's what I would hope they would
be. Well, of course, the clerks are never, I mean, they summarize cases, and obviously there's going to be some bias there, but clerks are never there to give their own opinion. They're there to reflect. You know, the justice is going to say, "Here's how I'm going to vote. Here are the main arguments I want you to make. Go ahead and write it." So I don't know that the change is probably that much different than it has been in the past.
So you don't think that it's ideology that matters with a clerk, but more research and writing skills?
Well, and a lot of hard work. The justices, you know, it used to be said that the justices were the only people in town who did their own work. I'm not sure that's as true anymore.
Brandeis said that.
Yeah, I think that's right. Now they do delegate a lot to the clerks. But, from time to time you'll get these books like The Brethren, you know, which sort of alludes or some kind of conspiracy among the clerks. I really don't think so. I think a justice is going to ultimately take control of the opinions. And, if you don't believe it, you know, compare a decision by Scalia or Thomas to one by Ginsburg, you can clearly see, you know, the justice's own imprint on the decisions.
The California Supreme Court has refused to order Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and Attorney General Jerry Brown to appeal a judge's ruling striking down the ban on same-sex marriage in that state. Since this is the case, and it looks as though the same-sex marriage issue will get to the U.S. Supreme Court sooner or later, if not this term, then in the one and next term, how do you determine who has legal standing? Doesn't this throw sort of a monkey wrench into the works?
Well, there'll be cases coming out of other states. You know, there are several other states who have adopted, you know, similar rulings to those in California. Tocqueville says, you know, there's almost no political issue in the United States that doesn't eventually become a legal issue. And the Supreme Court can ride it out maybe a term or two or three or four. But eventually they'll have to make a decision.
But this decision does not threaten David Boies and Ted Olson's legal standing as they try to go forward to defeat the ban.
I honestly don't know. It's a good question. I'm just not sure on that.
Not sure. One question I asked Ms. Totenberg is, as we get close to Constitution Day, I asked her for a reflection on the state of the separation of powers and how the judiciary has held up in maintaining its independence from the legislative and judicial and executive branches. And, of course, this partly touches on the contention by people on both the left and the right that too many judges are ideologues instead of displaying judicial temperament and judicial wisdom.
That's a fairly old criticism. I think it's, you know, valid at sometimes more than it is others. But I think a good bit of the criticism does stem from the fact that People on the court have, you know, have their own agendas. We wouldn't have the same system we do if they simply rolled over. And you know, you get the same thing in the issues of federalism. I'm sure that, you know, it won't be too long before we'll probably get some state challenges, successful or not, I don't know, because of the standing issue. But there'll certainly be some state challenges to the Obama health care plan. And sometimes the court intervenes more actively than it does in others.
How would you assess the Roberts Court so far in feeling empowered or unafraid to slap down things that come from both legislative and executive realms?
I think it's been more activist than people expected. But, you know, Roberts basically came in saying he was going to be an umpire. And for better or worse, I think that he has been more of a player than an umpire, and the rest of the court as well.
Sort of like that umpire who threw a fan out of the game the other day in Milwaukee. We are just about out of time, but before we go, we have to mention that Ms. Totenberg's lecture is being sponsored by the Distinguished Lecture Fund, the College of Mass Communication, the John Siegenthaler Chair of Excellence in First Amendment Studies, the School of Journalism, WMOT, the Jennings A. Jones College of Business, the University Honors College, the College of Liberal Arts, the University Provost, the American Democracy Project, and WPLN. Yes, I did that all in one breath. I really did. And Dr. John Vile, who has been our second guest today, as I said, is the author of the 15th edition of Essential Supreme Court Decisions, Summaries of Leading Cases in U.S. Constitutional Law, and also Volume 2 of another of his works has just come out. It's Civil Rights and Liberties, Constitutional Law in Contemporary America, which he co-edited with David Schultz and Michelle D. Deardorff. And in his spare time, he's dean of the University Honors College. We won't tell the Honors College Board of Visitors that I said that, will we?
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're also available on iTunes. Don't miss Nina Totenberg at MTSU September 22nd.